everybody. Welcome to Cosmos with Cosmos. As always, I'm Mike.
I'm Liz.
And I'm Brandon.
Hey!
Yay!
Hey!
The gang is back together.
Woo! Guess what we're talking about today? The three body problem.
Hey, topical! Oh,
it's like us.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Now, just to say, there will not be any TV show spoilers. We're going to minimize any TV show spoilers
or book spoilers.
Or really book spoilers as well. And it's just not about the media that has been re-released, but the science and the physics.
Yeah. We're going to talk about
educational people.
We're going to talk about a few things that show up.
Yes.
And just really the physics of it.
Yes.
And not so much how it's used as plot points and devices and things
yes.
like that.
Yes, yes. But we recommend you check it out, the movie or the TV show or the book.
I'm reading the book now. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's
I'm interested in reading the book.
Quick read. Quick and easy read. It even has a physics lesson on pull. How hitting a ball.
The game of pool.
The game of pool.
Oh, that makes sense because we're going to talk about chaos theory later on. And Malcolm from Jurassic Park has a great quote about chaos theory using pool as an example, which I actually have the quote up right now.
Oh, yay. Okay, I'm excited. I'm excited.
All right. Brandon, what's up? What you drinking, man?
Ooh, so I am drinking Rhodes. Where we're going, we don't need Rhodes.
Yes.
We'll get into that later on. But it's basically a maple syrup old fashioned.
Oh, yes.
All right. I guess he's got time before he's got.
Yeah.
Oh, and then for second drink, I have Tempranillo.
Ah.
Because I made some whiskey sours, not whiskey sour, New York sour earlier. Not today. And then I got a whole thing of wine, so now I got to drink wine.
Nice.
Oh, no.
You had a nice float on your New York sour.
I think put a little too much wine in it, which is fine because I like a lot of wine in it. But
no, it's fine.
I've recently been into this red wine called Three Finger Jack.
Oh, it's red wine.
I like it. Is it Cab? Is it Cabernet Sauvignon?
Yeah.
I think so, but it's really good.
Excellent.
I think I'll have that with dinner too.
What you drinking?
Oh, I am drinking the Three Liquor Problem.
Nice.
Looks like white wine.
It does look like white wine, but it's
like
not. It works well.
Wow.
It tastes much better. It has peach.
Schnapps. Butterscotch schnapps and cinnamon whiskey.
Yeah. So it's very sweet.
My favorite thing, I'm not sure if you know this, Liz, but you have a face you make when you don't know what's in the drink and you look at Mike. It's a very distinct face.
Is it the same?
It's not that face.
Oh.
It's a different face. You do it subconsciously.
Okay.
And I'm looking down and I can see.
You could just sense when I'm like, please give me the answers.
I can sense it.
When I need you to tip something, I'm like,
Basically, it's 2-1-1, so twice peach schnapps, and then cinnamon whiskey, and butterscotch schnapps are each one, each.
It's sweet. And then for my second drink, it's just a good old-fashioned Black Butte Porter from
But in the coolest koozie.
But in my astronaut koozie.
We ain't going nowhere.
Nope.
All right, so this little blue drink.
So much fun.
Ooh.
So pretty. So vibrant.
That is pretty. It's like Neptune.
Yes.
Yes.
I am calling it the Trisolarian.
Ooh, Trisolarian.
From the book.
Okay.
And
try. Three. Look at them go.
Yes. And so, but it has four things in it.
Oh, Trisolarian. Oh. Try three soul suns.
There you go. There you go.
And it has, in this case, you can do it two ways.
Oh, okay.
You can make it two ways. This has raspberry vodka.
Oh, you blue did the curacao. Raspberry
yeah.
vodka.
I bought that raspberry vodka just for this one drink. Uh-huh. I wanted to test it. And I have not tested it yet, but raspberry vodka,
uh-huh.
Blue curacao, mm-hmm. lime juice,
cow.
And a little simple syrup.
Nice.
But if you want to make it a different way, you can do white rum. Don't do dark rum. Jamaican rum.
The white rum, I tasted it, and it was pretty good.
Yeah, you want to use white rum because you want the blue color.
And regular vodka was pretty good.
Yeah.
Go, taste it. Let's see. How is it?
Oh, yeah, I can get behind that.
Yeah?
Excellent.
Yeah. So, this is a drink that
Ooh.
That I
Ooh. It's like it's a blue it's like blue raspberry flavor.
We watched Star Trek: The Undiscovered Country yesterday.
Nice.
Yes.
It is actually one of it's my favorite of the original movies.
Really?
Yeah, so love Undiscovered Country. And so we watched it, and this is the take on Romulan ale. So cheers, everybody.
I have a little bit of Romulan ale still left.
Oh, from the Romulan ale that you bought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my second drink is tea, vodka with peach syrup.
You can call that Klingon blood ale.
Yeah.
Actually, we do have a drink called Captain's Blood, which really comes out kind of as a pink color.
It does, so it could be Klingon blood ale.
Klingon blood.
Okay.
All right, so follow us on all the things on Twitter, because I will not use the other name. Drinking Cosmos on Twitter, Cosmos, and everything else. Rate us and follow us and rate us on wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to join us later for The Hangover.
Yeah.
All right. And as always, you want to check out Wild Ixia on Etsy. That is Wild IXIA. Get all kinds of really cool artwork. Friend of the pod, Ron Proctor. You can catch his stuff on the Mr. Proctor Show. And of course, .com. What's that?
.com.
.com.
Oh, yes. .com. Sorry. I'm like, I did give it a. All right. So, and if you're in the southwestern corner of Iowa, or I guess the northeastern corner of Nebraska, or something, I'm not sure how to say it. Anyway. If you're in the Council Bluffs area of Iowa, check out Rolling Bluffs Planetarium, Jack's Planetarium. You can check out rollingbluffsplanetarium.com for more information about what they got.
Yay!
Also, join us every other Wednesday for the shot.
I am overdue on making some of those.
Yeah,
yes, you are.
We need some coming up here.
Yeah, are we doing it next weekend?
Yeah, next weekend we have
to. I'll do like three in a row just me.
There you go.
Yeah, so if you like a little, what do you call it? Bite
just,
size?
Just shots of astronomy. If you like quick shots, quick tidbits, quick things, short form media.
It's great. We have all kinds of topics. We've done like 50 of them.
Yeah.
That's so much fun.
Yeah, we got one coming out on eclipse. One's out on eclipses.
And tomorrow.
Eclipse eye.
If you're watching this like right now, which I don't think anybody is, the eclipse is here tomorrow here in the States. I am
promoting the eclipse episode of The Shot tomorrow as well on social media.
All right, rules. As always, the puppy barks, go ahead and take a drink. Star Wars or Lord of the Rings references as well.
Any special rules today?
If Leia gets in our face, because she will get up.
Both dogs are in the room right now with us. They're just...
Who let the dogs in?
Yeah. Well, otherwise they whine, and then they get all... picture Jackie all sad. Which is
I was going with a bad reference to the Baja Men, but sure.
Yeah. I know you were. I know you were. Boys?
I've seen them live.
Bahamian.
That's a fun story when I saw them live.
I thought it was Bahamian.
Why did you see them live?
Anyway.
They were at Epcot.
Oh, it's Bahamian, yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, he said Baja Boys.
But I like alliteration. Anyway.
Baja Boys.
Let's get started. Let's jump right into it. You guys don't need to be doing all this other stuff.
Body problem.
All right, we're going to begin with a three-body problem because that is exactly the name of the book and show. And so we'll just start with it.
Sounds like when sounds like when a threesome goes wrong.
I mean, yes. I guess the aftermath.
Okay.
Oh.
Anyway, the three body problem in physics, not in sex, is famous for being unsolvable, but it has been solved.
Wait. It has been solved?
Yes, it has.
Oh, I didn't know it was solved.
Yeah.
I thought it was a forever problem.
Well, it is. And
a
you'll
mystery.
Find out,
a forever
find
mystery.
Out, you'll kind of find out how it is a problem. But okay. But it did in the... Well, you'll find out.
Okay, so when you say solved, it's more like it's been solved.
Right, but... but some of its solvings... Solutions, some of the solutions are useful, but most aren't. And there are going to be some solutions that we all know and love.
Okay.
and that we've heard of and we've talked about here on the podcast and all that kind of stuff. So let's start in the beginning.
Oh, all right.
So, what is a three-body problem?
The beginning. Doodoo.
Very good. So we do have to go back in time, 1687, to one Sir Isaac Newton.
Oh, the Newts.
Oh, who's that?
Yes, and from that, we have the two-body
problem. She turned him into a new and he didn't get better.
What?
She turned him into a new and he didn't get better.
I got better.
We are in the rare form already.
Ah, yes.
Anyway, from in 1687, Principia was unleashed upon the world. Oh. And within it, you have his equations of motion, you have the laws of gravity, and all that kind of stuff. And if you put all that together and you do some stuff, some calculus and some
which
math
he also
stuff,
invented.
Which he did invent.
He literally pulled out of his ass.
You actually can have the two-body problem, which is easy peasy to solve. It's really easy to solve. And it gives you a simple and exactly solvable solution, which in physics and math we call an analytic expression.
Analytic expression.
Yes.
So, I'll tell to my therapist, see how it goes.
I'm going to be so lost.
So basically what it did, Principia, what it did was it transformed an erratic and chaotic universe into one of predictability.
Oh, an orderly.
Orderly,
logical, Vulcan universe.
So the two-body system, it has equations that basically describe the path the body follows around whatever the other thing is.
Okay.
The star, planet, you know, that kind of
central
thing. And you've heard of them, ellipses.
Yes.
Parabolas.
Yes.
Hyperbole. These are all conic sections. Uh-huh. So if you have a cone and you take a slice out of it, you can get all three of these.
Mm, slice.
Yes.
Okay.
So they're called conic sections.
This is a lot of high-level math that I never got to.
High-level math cones.
I love math cones, yes.
Well, you know what a cone looks like, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right, never mind.
I got that far in my visualization. And it was a road cone, if anybody wants to know what I visualize as a cone.
Okay. Only one case has a simple solution. Only one case.
Okay.
Excellent.
And that is when you have two bodies orbit each other without any other gravitational influences from the rest of the universe.
So
can that happen?
No.
No, because every gravity is everywhere is affecting every gravity other is. Gravity is everywhere.
Unless it's like Leia going around Liz, then nothing will impact that.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Okay, so we already know that the two body solution, easy peasy to solve, but it's just not really what is seen
it's
in the
not,
universe.
It's not elegant?
No, it is elegant.
Oh, okay.
It is elegant.
Okay.
It's an elegant solution. However, it doesn't perfectly describe how the universe
is. Yeah, because the universe is wild and wacky. It seems like we can explain one thing, but then we need to like do new math to just explain one other thing just because it's slight, like Mercury orbit versus, you know, the rest of the planet's orbits kind of thing. You know, you need two different types of physics.
Right. And so once we came up with, like I'm involved.
Yes. Okay. You're a human species. So
yes,
are we.
Once people that were smart came up with a solution for the two-body problem, they started to look for, you know, three or more. They wanted to add.
Oh, they wanted to add more problems because, you know, until you get to 99 problems.
Right. So astronomers and mathematicians started looking for a solution for three more bodies. It became an obsession.
I love when scientists get obsessed with one thing.
I
love those stories.
It really did become an obsession with a lot of people.
The brain equations all over the walls.
We quickly found out that chaos rules.
Chaos.
When you do this. And we also found out that it seemed impossible to solve. So, in fact, so much so that in the late 1800s, Ernest Bruns and Henri Poincaré, in French.
You did Henri, right?
Henri Poincaré said that no general analytic solution exists.
Ah, well, that's that then.
So
now this is
basically said it can't be solved.
This is specifically three or three plus.
Three plus.
So anything after two is like,
anything after two. and they said it can't be solved.
Okay, never.
The interesting thing is, we'll get to this later, was 20 years later, somebody did come up with a solution, but it's impractical. But they did come up with a solution.
Okay. Is it a solution if it doesn't work?
The one that was 20 years later. All right, so there was a Finnish, I don't know if he was a mathematician or a physicist, but he used what is called a series in math, and it basically would need 10 to the 8 terms. So that is 10 million terms just to be able to do a simple or an average astrophysics calculation. It's just not usable. You would need a computer to do it now. You couldn't write out all those terms on a piece of paper because it just wouldn't.
That's when you need the paper. Walls. That's when you need the walls.
Yeah. And so his name was Sundman and Carl Sundman, and he used a power series, and it's 100 million terms for a simple celestial mechanics calculation. So it's not very useful.
We got computers, though.
But he did find a solution.
Okay, all right.
And so, but anyway. I just think it's funny that, they say it can't be solved, and then 20 years later it kind of happens. But, so the question is why? Why is the three-body problem... What'd you say?
I said, do we care? Why do we need why do we need three-plus bodies?
Well...
Well,
I know most of star systems are binary.
But in all seriousness, if you look at our solar system, mm-hmm. you look at the sun, yeah. Jupiter, and Saturn, it's pretty much automatically a three body.
Oh, okay. I was going to say we got eight bodies and Pluto's not one.
Yeah. So you do need it. It's very important to be able to make these calculations for like a long time ago. You needed it for like celestial navigation. Mm-hmm. But also more importantly, now we're launching all this shit everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you kind of need it for that as well.
Yes.
All right. So why is it so chaotic? So the evolution of a three body system, mm-hmm. Is always dominated by, chaotic dynamics. So what does that mean? That means that future states, where things are and uh-huh, how they're uh-huh. moving, is highly dependent upon small changes in initial conditions. So if you, let's say you have a three-body problem, so the sun, Jupiter, and Earth. If you move Jupiter just a little bit, it causes big implications for where the Earth will be, 100 million years from now.
Yes, yes.
And so, in fact, in 2019, there was a solar system simulation done where they wanted to calculate where everything was going to be.
Let's fuck with the planets a little bit.
Yeah, everything was going to be in 5 billion years. Yeah,
fuck you, Venus.
Yeah. So they ran 2,000 simulations.
Okay.
Everything stayed the same except for one planet. And what they did was they changed Mercury's orbit by 1 millimeter.
What?
Was it a millimeter?
It was a millimeter from one simulation to the next. Remember, you're going over large time frames here.
Uh-huh.
So true. 1 millimeter true. Changing Mercury's position 1 millimeter now. Isn't going to really change anything in our lifetime, but over 5 billion years, it does. So in 1% of the simulations, Mercury hits the sun or Venus.
Oh, but then how's that fuck up the rest of us?
That time, the sun will swallow us anyway.
Well, shh.
In one simulation, the... In one simulation, one of 2,000, mm-hmm. the entire inner solar system was fucked up. It got destabilized. Shit went everywhere.
Everything's just like, until it eventually what? Either flies, well, no, it had to fall in the sun eventually, no? Or it would eventually stabilize.
Not necessarily. Because
Meanwhile, Jupiter's just like,
usually,
what's going on, guys?
Usually, yeah. So usually one body, one of the bodies actually gets ejected.
Which one?
Well, probably the smaller mass object.
Is Mercury?
Maybe.
Goes flying?
Yeah, but it also could be us.
So, that'd be kind of fun. Well, shot out of the solar system.
You know, for a little bit until it gets real cold.
Real dark.
So basically, it's a conservation of momentum kind of thing. Conservation of energy.
Yeah.
So if you just have two objects, if you have the sun and the earth, the earth. So conservation of energy means that energy can't be created or destroyed. It can't just
appear out of nowhere. It has to go somewhere else. It has to go somewhere.
We're going
to
ignore quantum physics for a moment.
Okay. Put it down.
And so it just can't come out of nowhere. You can't. You're going around the sun, and all of a sudden, you can't just receive all this energy from
somewhere
and send you flying, change your orbit, that kind of thing. So, in a two body problem, the Earth is always locked in orbit around the sun.
Right.
So, if you have, like, say, two stars and a big planet like Jupiter, those stars can transfer energy back and forth with each other, and that changes the dynamics of things. So, the energy of the system as a whole doesn't change.
Right. It's just constant. The transferring that same energy around. Yeah.
Like Ben and J-Lo. Yeah. Their star power is equal, but it goes back and forth between the two.
Right. Yes. They can transfer that.
Right. And power. So that has implications for other things.
Right.
Jupiter. And where, you know, what
is. Because then if one star gets more energy, then that's going to bring Jupiter to it more, or it's going to I don't know.
Don't think mass here. Energy
is not mass, yes.
It is, but it's not.
Right.
In this particular thing, we're not going to worry about that.
Okay.
Portion of it. So.
Then what do you mean by transferring
energy? So. Gravitationally, a star, they're going to exchange some energy, so this star starts to move a little bit faster. That has implications you know, it's going to move quicker, it's going to move out, that's going to change.
Right. It's like all of a sudden your year gets shorter.
Right.
Or something happens.
And so all of that chaotic nature can, usually lead to a smaller object being ejected from the system. And what it does is it makes the remaining system become a two-body problem, which is really kind of what it wants to be.
It wants to be. Okay. So
it's a natural state of being.
Every 3+ body issues, like, we just want to be slimmer.
Yeah.
We want to be a nice even 2.
Yes.
A nice, is that a prime number? 2.
Right. And so the thing is, though, is that when we look out into the universe, We see three-body problem. Three-body systems.
Everywhere.
All you got to do is look to the closest star to our sun, Alpha Centauri. Three-body system.
Chaotic system.
It is a chaotic system by nature. And so...
Is it naughty?
If you look at the solar system... It's a three-body problem. It's an n-body problem because you have...
It's an n-body.
Yeah, because...
Much of nth?
Yeah, because you have 8 planets. You have this...
God, I forgot to add planets.
Yeah, and so they get in this... They have to be considered in this as well.
Yes.
If you look at the Earth and the Moon, it's a three-body problem with the Sun.
Yeah, and the moon is slowly drifting further away from us.
Right.
Which is going to fuck us up
process,
in the
long run,
I guess.
but it is. Different process, though. Earth, Sun, Jupiter is a three-body problem. Sun, Jupiter, Saturn is a three-body problem.
We seem to be managing okay, though, in our solar system.
You're managing okay, yeah, because at the end of the day, at the end of the day, Jupiter's mass is small compared to the sun.
Right. And everything in the solar system is small. The mass is small compared to the sun. So it's inconsequential. Yeah.
So what it does is it kind of reduces to a bunch of two-body problems.
Right. It's and like so the sun and...
Earth and the sun. Jupiter and the sun.
Yeah.
Mars and the sun. Mercury and the sun. The problem is the orbits will shift over time because it's... Not
this
just
sounds like a fun part. Anthology. Oh, a kids' anthology series. Mercury in the Sun. Venus in the Sun. Mm-hmm. Earth in the Sun.
And it's all kind of the same story. We all just go around the sun.
Yeah.
Earth, it sounds really big.
That'd actually be great if that's all it was for each one of them.
All right, so...
Golden book set.
I used to love golden books. All because you can't get an analytic solution for a three-body problem, that doesn't mean... that you don't have a solution.
Okay, it's just not analytic.
It's just not analytic. It's not that. It's not that pretty elegant equation where you can pop in. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. Where you can pop in some numbers, get something out, and that's exactly
right. It's not a nice plug and play USB.
Right. So you can approximate things. You can approximate things. So if bodies are far apart, you can approximate. As a series of those two-body problems, which I talked about. Okay. So the planets are spread out in our solar system, and they're not even all lined up in the same direction, right. So it's even further from each other. And so you just say Sun, Mercury, Sun.
Right, okay. So a Venus, series of two-body problems. Yes.
All right. If one of the bodies has a very low mass compared to the other two, then that low-mass object can be, its gravitational effects can be ignored.
Excellent.
It's great for satellite orbits, approximating the moon's orbit relative to the Earth and Sun, the Earth's orbit relative to the Sun and Jupiter, and that is actually called the reduced three-body problem.
Reduced three-body problem. Nice. Reduced.
Yeah, okay. And that's what...
the R3B.
That's what a lot of people like to use and that type of thing, but... but it does fail to perfectly predict well into the future.
That's science. Got to predict.
Yeah, got to be able to predict. It can get you. It can get you. You know, a few hundred million years out. But that's it.
If that's it, then let's just throw the theory away.
But then things start. Changing in a way that you can't.
Yeah, and then. Exactly, that you can't predict because you have the effects of. Jupiter going on, you could have a star that will
swing by, when Andromeda starts getting a little too close, it's gonna fuck some shit up. It's gonna cause a lot of three-body problems, I'm assuming.
Right. So there's a thing called numerical integration, which Newton also kind of worked out a little bit.
Okay.
Basically, it's where you break up the problem into
sections. Manageable sections.
Chores.
Yeah, and then you combine them together, and then you're like, all right.
So you break it up, you break the motion up into really small time steps.
Okay.
And then you solve it. So you go, okay, let's take a look at right now. What's the effects that everything is on the Earth? All right. And so you figure out what the net force is. And you apply that force to the Earth, and then you go forward, I don't know, a day. Whatever your time step is, a day. Then you figure out all the forces again, and then that you adjust the Earth's movement based on that, and you go forward a day.
Okay.
And so
step by step.
Isn't there a song called Step by Step?
Well, there's also the TV show Step by Step. Day by day.
I just thought.
Okay. With Suzanne Summers. She was in the TV show Step by Step.
All right.
Anyway. I think it was on a, it might have been on a TGIF at one point.
Okay.
But.
I don't know. So there are some solutions to this. We talked about Sundman. Yes. Carl Sundman already.
Yes.
But he wasn't the first one to come up with a solution. Euler and Lagrange.
Oh,
Euler.
Lagrange, known for Lagrange points, maybe?
Maybe. So Euler found out there was a solution where you have three bodies.
For those of you listening, Euler is spelled E-U-L-E-R.
Right. He was a man. It'd be great if he was like An oil man.
An oil man.
Oiler the Oiler.
Yes, founder of the Oilers.
Anyway, Euler found a solution where three bodies orbit a common center of mass.
Okay.
And they remain in a straight line with each other. So basically, they're in constant eclipse.
Oh, that's cool.
That's the coolest science fiction setting.
Yeah.
Yeah, constant eclipse.
Yeah, so they're moving in a straight line relative to each other all the time. And so it's constant eclipse.
All right. And it's always like a weird twilight.
It's like pitch black's worst nightmare. Get Vin Diesel on the phone.
All right, so Lagrange found a solution where three bodies form an equilateral triangle.
Excellent.
So they all have, think of it as a triangle, where each object is a vertice in a triangle.
Okay.
They're all the same distance from each other, equilateral. And so basically this equilateral triangle just continually goes around the center of mass and all that kind of stuff. So,
and this is our favorite solution to the three-body problem.
Spheres making a triangle.
Yeah. So if you take Euler and Lagrange's solutions, they describe five orbits that can be described with simple equations. Those are the only simple equation solutions to the three-body problem.
Hey.
And today, those orbits are known as the Lagrangian points.
L points.
Hey.
L points.
That's where James Webb is at, one of them.
Yeah, L2. So it's
gravitationally nestled.
Yes. In a little pocket, a little nook.
Those are the only simple solutions to the three-body problem. So you can solve it, but they're for very special cases.
Okay.
But they're kind of useful.
It has to be these scenarios, okay,
right.
But then there's like infinite number of scenarios for a three-body problem. Okay.
So in the 1970s, Michael Hennen and Roger Broke found a solution involving two masses bouncing back and forth in the center of a third body's orbit. So bouncing makes it think of like a tennis ball going back and forth,
but
really and truly, they're orbiting each other, right?
Yeah.
And so this third body is really far out, orbits the two of those, Alpha Centauri.
Okay.
So found a solution for that. Also, Kepler 453, which is the Tatooine planet.
Hey, Tatooine! Two suns. What a hot desert, though.
So we're going to assume Tatooine is massive enough where it could be really kind of not ignored in this.
Okay.
So you do have the two stars.
I mean, here's just a side question. Can a rocky world get large enough to be, or do you have to be a
gas giant? I can't imagine that being possible. Even with like a massively huge metallic core, it's just not nearly big enough.
Yeah.
Anti-physics, man?
I mean, I'm not gonna say it can't, because I'm sure that I don't necessarily know of a reason why it can't, but that doesn't mean anything.
I've never thought about that. What's the mass limit of terrestrial planets?
Yeah, I don't know. So all right, of course, the bigger it gets, the more massive it gets, which means more gravity. So you are going to, it's going to heat up that core.
Right.
It's also going, that heat is going to be, I bet that planet's going to be more volcanic. Volcanic.
Right. Because we found super Earths that are like a couple times the Earth's diameter, but they are like...
Yeah, but it also
the largest terrestrial planet is considered the one before you get too thick of an atmosphere. So it happens between 5 and 10 Earth masses, so about 2 Earth radii, apparently.
Yeah. So
not Jupiter.
You know. So basically, you know, next week they're going to find a planet that just blows that out the water.
There's
everything
always an exception.
We do was wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. So. But, you know, I don't know a reason why you can't, but that doesn't mean that it shows up in the universe.
Right.
So, all right. So that's 1970s and 1990s. Chris Moore Yes, that is his name. C-R-I-S, not eight. No eight.
He sounds like a comic book writer. Chris Moore.
He does. He found a solution for a figure eight motion of three equal mass objects. So, just pointless.
That's the infinity system.
It is the infinity. That's exactly what it's called.
Oh, really? The infinity system? Yeah. Yes.
So they're always basically the same distance from each other.
That's cool. That would be cool.
I like
cool.
that. Keep your distance. I like that.
Forever.
So basically, after that, you have what's called the Shapesphere. Richard Montgomery.
William Shakespeare?
Yeah. The Shapesphere. Richard Montgomery came up with this. Basically, if you draw a line between all the different characters in it, so the three characters, mm-hmm. you make a triangle, right? And so, and as time goes, that triangle changes its shape, but it's still always a triangle. So he found that if you map that triangle onto a sphere, we won't really get into...
This is cool. Yeah.
The orbits actually become simpler. You would think they would be a little bit more complex, but the motion of that changing triangle is very complex. But when you map it onto a sphere, it actually becomes a little bit more, it becomes a little simpler, and you can actually see the periodic nature of it, I guess. Mm-hmm. You can see the shape of the orbits and things like that. And so, basically, Euler and Lagrange's solutions pop out of this pretty easily. There's also a whole lot of other solutions that pop out where you can write up, you know, an equation.
But it has to be where their orbits are doing this triangle thing.
Well, but on the sphere, it doesn't look like a triangle. On the sphere, it looks like circular shapes. Mm. And so it's very, actually kind of pretty. It's very geometric and things like that. And, you know, would I want it as a tattoo? No, but it still looks pretty cool. So from that, a lot of other solutions were discovered to the three-body problem.
Okay.
But none of them are likely to be found in nature.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, then how does that work? They found solutions, but these weren't going to exist out in the natural universe
Pretty
world.
Much. Yeah.
Well, okay.
It's a good way of visualizing things and finding solutions, but most of the solutions just don't work for, you know, the real world.
Yeah.
It doesn't. And what it means is that nature isn't going to... So you can get the solution, and so therefore they are permissible in the universe.
Oh, okay.
So it could show up in the universe. However, the chances of it showing up are pretty remote and almost zero. But given all the galaxies in the universe and all of that, it might show up once.
Sweet.
Okay.
But, and then the one time it does happen, the people there would think this is normal and it should exist everywhere.
Or that system doesn't last long.
Right.
Oh.
And it ejects a member and reduces down to that two-body problem.
Okay.
Or becomes...
That two-body problem sounds like a two-body solution. Like, I don't see many problems with it. This is just the natural state of things.
No problems. It just is. Two bodies.
Yeah. So there's a
two-body ideal.
Hey, Jackie. No.
I was going to say, was that a puppy bark or was that
no,
a puppy
that
like,
was,
sleep?
That was Jack licking Lay's ear.
Yeah.
So this quote is from PBS. I can't remember the guy's name, but it was on PBS. He's on PBS. The three-body problem is perfectly solvable uselessly or for seemingly useless and bizarre orbits, except for the Lagrange points. And it may be approximately solved for useful and practical orbits with enough precision to work just fine.
That's all we need. We just need it to work.
What do we need it for other than Lagrange points right now? In
satellites.
Reality?
Satellites.
Okay.
Yeah, so we need it to launch
exploration.
Ship places.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So it's very Yeah, you know, the great thing is
we don't need it to save civilization on another planet.
No. Okay. No, but
that come in handy.
Right.
One day.
But you know, so we needed to launch shit mm-hmm. now, and what's really helped us with all of this are computers. Computers yes, allow us to do it.
Our future overlords.
Yeah. But before there were computers, there were human computers yes. that did all the calculations for you.
Yeah, human beings.
Yeah, and so it was slow, it was laborious, and computers
and
can now...
unappreciated.
It was. So computers
especially if you're a woman,
for you.
And especially if you're a woman of color.
Unless you're Alan Shepard, then he really appreciated the computers, because he would die without them.
Yeah.
So that is three body problem.
Excellent. Okay. Good podcast.
Okay, so basically in a nutshell, if you could nutshell the three body problem, it's like when you got three or more bodies, things get weird and chaotic. And yeah. It's hard to fucking solve for that shit.
Yeah, things get really insane.
Yeah, okay.
And quickly in a lot of cases. So and it's just really hard to calculate, but that's an important part of physics and things that might be.
Right, because again, most of the times there's more than just two things mm-hmm. that are, you know, you're trying to account for.
All right, let's move on. Let's move on to a topic that Brandon really likes, nuclear propulsion.
Excellent. Excellent.
It does show up.
When things that go boom make you go far.
Nuclear propulsion actually was first yeah. thought of in 1903 as a means to propel cars, trains, and boats using radon.
Radon?
You don't want in your house anyway.
Right. That's when you like you have people come and like mm-hmm. scan your house for radon and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I feel like using anything nuclear to propel anything that like... I don't know. You're in a commuter fashion, cars, trains.
That may be a bad automobiles. Idea.
Not great.
Right, but in 1903, though,
it was like, ooh, oh, this could be
yeah.
fun.
I mean,
they didn't see a bomb go off.
No, but you also 1920s. You had the glow in the dark watches where the women were painting the dials, and basically their faces fell off. Yeah, because they're using like radon and stuff like that, or something. It was some sort of radioactive material, and their faces literally fell off.
I bet
they got cancer with their jaw and all that.
There was definitely at least one, if not more, women that painted their fingernails with that glow in the dark paint.
Maybe, and then
I would.
I mean, I would.
So in 1914, H.G. Wells publishes *The World Set Free*, which uses nuclear propulsion. Also, in it, it talks about basically nuclear bombs before the nuclear bomb.
I mean, it's not okay. So, when did we first be like, "Hey, things are nuclear; we can have nuclear power"?
Well, I don't know about nuclear power, but you know, obviously, in the 1920s and 30s, they knew about nuclear. Because right. they're trying to figure out within like quantum physics and what's going on. We knew about like, you know, radioactive
right.
decay.
Right.
That
I
kind
mean,
of
it makes
thing.
Sense that then it would be like, whoa, let's make bombs.
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not far. It's not. It's pretty easy to visualize the bombs before the bombs happen.
All right. So you can use fission, which is the splitting of an atom.
Yes.
To create the energy needed for thrust if you're going to have nuclear propulsion. We'll get into the two types that are now used here in a moment, but there's a third type, which Brandon I know loves. But NASA's been looking at nuclear propulsion for over 60 years. Mm-hmm. And right now, the reactor temperature inside of it would be 4,600 degrees Fahrenheit. So materials... What?
But that's it. 2,600 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, but so you would need materials that could withstand that temperature. Mm-hmm. For everybody else in the world, it's about 2,540 degrees Celsius.
Okay. Isn't Brandon doing this part?
Oh, I'll get there. Don't worry.
Okay.
Yeah. nuclear propulsion could allow for, one of the benefits is it could allow for more flexible abort scenarios, which Brandon added a question mark to that.
Basically asking, what the fuck?
Yeah, what?
Yeah, so...
and is that a good idea to abort?
Hop in the nuclear escape pod.
Well, so basically, if something goes wrong, that there's a few more options in which the astronauts, if further along in their journey, they can now escape and get back home.
Okay. So in the scenario that we eventually send astronauts to Mars, some shit happens. There's maybe an escape pod powered by nuclear power that they can return home in a reasonable amount of time.
Yes, exactly.
And not starve or dehydrate to death.
Right. So, so that's... I
mean, when in Rome.
Yeah, I mean, straight from NASA's website. So basically, it's going to allow for them to be able to, because if you don't have nuclear, that means you got chemical,
right?
And so you're going to be.
I mean, you know,
nuclear. Chemical is not as efficient. Mm-hmm. So then,
would chemical be more combustive, or explosive?
Nuclear is.
Than nuclear?
Well, I'll tell you what.
We will get to it.
Okay.
All right. The energy density for nuclear, for uranium-235, is 560,000 times that of hydrogen.
Jesus Christ.
So you get more energy from nuclear than you would from a chemical reaction with hydrogen.
You can imagine uranium is more sludgy, and now, hydrogen is more.
Now forgive me. U-236, isn't that what we use for RTGs, for Perseverance and Curiosity? It's one away from the actual nuclear weapons for RTGs.
Sure. This is the only one that I have a number on.
Okay.
So it is, basically, it is... more efficient than chemical rockets, and it will give you more thrust than chemical rockets. That's why you have more scenarios with nuclear, in that if you're further in your trip to Mars, shit goes wrong, you then can use a nuclear propulsion to get you home, because it'll give you more speed to get back home, whereas chemical reactions, just not as efficient. Mm-hmm.
I am going to make a Weird Al-esque parody band called My Chemical Rockets.
All right. So there are two types types of nuclear propulsion that they're looking at now. There's thermal and electric. Thermal has high thrust and twice the propellant efficiency than chemical rockets. Basically, what it does is it transfers heat from the reactor to liquid propellant. The liquid goes to gas, expands through the nozzle, producing the thrust.
So extremely similar to just nuclear plants in general, just creating,
There's also electric.
Oh, I love this.
Which has a lower thrust than thermal. But what it does is it generates electricity that positively charges the gas propellant, positive ions, and that is pushed out through a thruster, which gives it the thrust. It's not as... its thrust is not as great as thermal, but it still gives you
thrust.
So those are the two that they're looking at now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use nuclear stuff for New Horizons and all those spacecrafts that are going far because we need it.
Right. Well, that's batteries.
Last longer.
Yeah, those are batteries, not necessarily for propulsion.
So here's the question.
Oh, that's fair. That's true.
Here's the question. Can we use a bunch of bombs, nuclear bombs, to make us go really fast?
The answer is
in theory, yes.
Can we, Brandon?
In theory, yes.
You may be asking, why is Brandon here in this episode? And I'm going to respond that, one, Mike hates the sound of me pouring things. And number two, because there's spaceflight involved. And when there's spaceflight involved, I get very excited. Enter one of my favorite projects of all time, Project Orion, which I was going to say at some point is going to show up as a shot episode, 100%, because I love this.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So the idea is, just like Mike said, is you have a spacecraft. Well, there's two different ways of thinking about it, but the main one is basically you have a spacecraft in space and it's moving forward, but then it poops out pellets of nuclear bombs, and these poops explode.
Nuke poop.
Yeah, Nuke poops.
I'm really so happy that you used my thing from the end of notes.
Oh, did I?
Poops out, yes.
Oh. I didn't even see that.
A spacecraft. I have a spacecraft.
All of our brains work the same way.
I didn't even think. I think of like rabbit poops, like little pellets. Or was it wombats that do cubes? Anyway.
Yes.
These spacecraft will poop out nuclear bombs, explode, and then you have this huge plate on the spacecraft, and it will use the shockwave. Not shockwave's a bad term in space, but it will use that force of the bomb to propel it. Right. And you drop hundreds of these things to reach like 1% the speed of light. Have you slowed down? Nuclear weapons. Nuclear bombs. You just keep popping them off, and you'll slow down eventually that way as well. But it's just an absolute batshit cocaine straight line theory, and I love it so very much. Now, the other idea was, how do you get to orbit in the first place? And this was, well, what if you also need to use nuclear bombs and use it as a force to actually get you into orbit?
Yeah,
and you know what? This was tested.
What?
I think it was like November of 59.
Of course it was tested.
Yeah, but they didn't use nuclear bombs, right? It was chemical.
It was they were chemical bombs. And they only got 10 meters up. But still.
So it was feasible.
I mean, the logic of it, using the force from the explosion to propel, it's sound. You know, it makes sense. I mean,
at the end of the day, rocket launchers just control explosions anyway.
Yeah.
But we're going to go back a little bit and kind of start where this came from for a moment. Back in 1946, Stanislaw Ulam proposed it. And he actually worked at Los Alamos in 47. And he took this as he's working next to literally Einstein and Oppenheimer. And he had this idea, and he tried proposing it, but it wasn't really a serious idea because it didn't have any names or theories back to it. So he actually went to a name we love in astronomy, Freeman Dyson.
Ah, Dyson sphere. Mm-hmm. Also expensive vacuums.
Also expensive that, but a different thing.
Yeah,
so
different Dyson.
So Islam there went to Freeman Dyson to get his political power, and it got enough to was given $1 million a year, which back in the 50s was a lot of money, to study and propose. Because at this time, you know, we're still trying to find applications for nuclear power and nuclear energy as opposed to just bombs. So they thought, what if we actually use nuclear power spacecraft to poop ourselves to other stars? And the benefit, actually, is that you can have far larger spacecraft than like the Saturn V, even. Because as opposed to a three-person capsule like Eagle or Snoopy, you can have 150 people in this massive capsule that uses this nuclear bomb energy to launch itself off.
Layman appearance.
That's right. It was a secret.
Mm-hmm. Secret rule.
And speaking of secrets, the paper that Islam wrote in 1946, at least in 2002, is still classified.
Really?
Yeah. So most of this stuff is still classified. Anything dealing with nuclear is probably going to be classified.
Right, of course, you know.
So for about one to two decades, it was seriously studied by DARPA, for example, and a couple of other agencies, until we signed the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which basically says you can't explode nuclear bombs in
the atmosphere. Yeah, because we all live here on this damn hippies. Planet. Can we not fuck up the planet?
There was also fear of fallout.
Yeah, fallout's an issue.
Yeah, because we're dealing with shit that basically either kills you immediately or kills you slowly in a horrible way over time.
The big problem wasn't exploding bombs into space, which I think Russia just talked about a couple months ago, and a different story. But it was the fear of getting those nuclear explosions into space in the first place, which has to be done by a conventional rocket launch. So
by an explosion.
So let's say, for example, we have our big giant Saturn V rocket. What happens if it explodes on launch pad carrying megatons of nuclear explosion on top of it?
Yeah, that's bad news bears.
Whoops, Daisy.
Yeah, I mean, people freaked out.
Goodbye, Florida. We'll see.
People freaked out with, I want to say it was Cassini.
Yeah, with the RCGs on there.
Yeah.
And so I forget who it was. I was at the FAA or the FAST, something like that. They had to have special casings around these RCGs. So if it did explode, the rocket explode, that this RCG would not leak at all, or, you know, don't do what it does.
Right. Mm. I mean, it's a risk. That if we're going to play with nukes, this is the risk, you know? If we're going to play with these elements, we have to be prepared for the consequences of playing with these elements.
So this is 100% going to be a shot episode because I want to go more in depth on that. Yes. But right. I love Project Orion.
Well, then let's move on. What All right, it? one final thing before we call it a day is quantum entanglement.
Oh boy!
It is a bizarre and counterintuitive quantum phenomenon.
How bizarre?
Yeah. So.
Well, anytime you mention quantum, things get fucking.
Where two particles are connected and share information, even when separated at large distances.
Isn't that also spooky physics? Or is that different?
Nope, it's the same thing. The term quantum entanglement was coined by Edwin Schrödinger in 1935.
Oh, there
you
go.
Yes, of cat dead and alive, or alive, and alive. Yeah, it is in response
to Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen paper that said quantum was incomplete and not a theory that really describes nature.
Now, really quick, I want to point out in the notes, he has Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, initials as EPR. Yeah. And that makes me think like a boy band. Here comes EPR. And it's like Einstein coming out on Rosen Podolsky doing the thing.
Yeah, so it's dancing. It's known as the EPR paper. And so Schrodinger took exception to the EPR paper. And he wrote a paper. And
I take exception. I like the battle of papers.
He wrote a paper. He also wrote a letter.
That's
Einstein.
A scientist fight right there.
And he coined the term quantum entanglement. And so what is it? So
it's a cool term.
It is.
All right. So I don't know how well this is going to work, but I have two coins for people that are watching, which is nobody. But I have two coins.
It doesn't matter. This is
And they are two quarters. One is the Georgia quarter. One is the Arkansas quarter.
Oh, okay. Does that matter for the experiment?
These are not entangled. If I were to flip them, 50-50 shot, heads or tails, it doesn't matter what one coin gets. The other one still has a 50-50 shot.
Unless it's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern the dead.
Okay.
Literary reference.
Yeah. All right. So let's say I do a magic trick, though, with these.
Oh, we've been watching that magic show.
So exactly. Just like that.
Hey.
Except with coins and not my thumb. But anyway, I'm doing a magic trick. And so I magically entangle these two quarters.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Right.
And so I give one to you and one to Brandon.
Oh.
Thank you.
And you guys go on this magic adventure in opposite directions. So you get in a rocket. You get in a rocket.
I have my coin. You never gave it to me.
You get in a rocket and you go opposite directions, and you guys are on opposite sides of the solar system from each other.
Okay.
But they're magically entangled. Delicious. So what it means is if we flip one and it comes up heads, the other one is automatically tails. No matter what.
Okay.
If I flip this quarter and it comes up tails, the other one automatically heads. Uh-huh. It's the opposite.
Will that happen right now? Can we do that? Will it happen?
You can do it. Do it.
How do you flip a coin?
I want to hear the cool flip sound.
It's heads.
What is it?
Heads.
Heads. So this one is automatically tails. Crazy how that came up.
Flip it though. Let's see if it comes up actually tails though.
Let's do really statistics. Fun.
It is tails.
It did come up tails.
Hey!
Whoa! Spooky.
So, you guys have these magic quarters, and lay it off.
Oh, well, she tried off. That. She's very insistent today. Go lie down, honey. Go lie down. Go lie down. Go away. Go away.
All right, so you guys go on opposite ends of the solar system.
Uh-huh.
And you flip yours, and you have a 50-50 shot of heads or tails, right?
Uh-huh.
But for Brandon, it is a 100% chance.
So I determine Brandon's
that it
fate.
Is the opposite of yes. You determine.
That's wild.
It's whoever goes first really
That's
determines
wild.
The other fate.
Yeah, yeah. Whoever goes.
But since we're married, you go first. And Brandon just has to deal with it. So you guys automatically know what the other person has. You are on opposite sides of the solar system. But you flip your coin, it comes up heads, you know instantly Brandon has tails.
Uh-huh.
So you know this information. Now, see, Einstein's big problem was is that nothing should go faster than the speed of light, right. And that includes information.
Right.
And so that information is going to take time to go from you to Brandon because you go, hey, I got heads, but Brandon already has tails. And so Einstein says, because of this, it violates relativity. Quantum physics is incorrect, that it is not a real theory of the universe.
Look, man, things just get weird.
Things do get weird.
Things just get weird. Einstein.
And so, but you...
People can blunder now and then. Yeah. Have big blunders. Exactly. It's fine.
Yeah. But you automatically know what Brandon has, and Brandon automatically knows what you have. And so it seems like this information has gone faster than the speed of light. So these are quarters, though. So the question is, does it really show up in other things in nature? Leia, go lie down. And yes, it does. They're a quantum tale.
A quantum tale! Yeah. Another Golden Book series.
Take that, Fible.
So in physics, you can entangle two particles. Okay. We've done it with photons and such. Basically, if you have two particles and you do a neutral spin on them, means that one of them is up, the other one is down. It's always like that. So it's a neutral spin. You can separate and measure them. So you've created these particles in such a way that they're entangled. We have done this, really, this with photons.
This is crazy that we can do this.
Then you separate them. Uh-huh. You measure the spin of one. And you know the spin of the other one, you measure it, and it's the opposite. And so Einstein referred to this as a spooky action at a distance. It violates relativity, which is what he was all upset about. But Einstein was the first to kind of think about this. And his thoughts were conceptual, though. He didn't really have any math to back it up.
That's not like Einstein.
But he's actually a thought experimenter, so it might be hard. It might be harder for him to do a thought experiment on this kind of thing.
Well, the whole EPR paper was a thought experiment about it, and so he just couldn't back it up with math. And to be fair, it took another 30 years before somebody could
to get the math for it.
Well, to really figure it out, and it was an Irish physicist named John Bell.
He was lucky.
Right. And so he turned the ideas into equations that could then be tested. He didn't test it, but he came up with...
Look, I did the math.
It's called the Bell inequality or the Bell theorem or something like that. Okay. And there were three physicists that really took on the mantle of trying to prove it or disprove it. And Alan Aspect, John Clauser, and Anton... Zellinger, and they won the 2022 Nobel Prize for experiments with entangled photons, establishing the violation of Bell inequalities and pioneer quantum information science. And so they got it for quantum entanglement. We don't fully understand it, but we know it's a fundamental aspect of nature.
Well, 2022 for the Nobel Prize for it.
One of my favorite things is in planetarium shows, we get all sorts of great questions or fun, weird, strange questions. And typically you have
some kind of... One of my favorite question was, what's that behind you?
Oh, God, that's a whole other story.
That's spooky physics right there.
I don't like that question. But typically you have an answer or you can speculate on an answer. But anytime somebody asks anything about quantum, like, I don't fucking know.
I know. It's like,
and that was my quote. I don't fucking know, you 12-year-old.
Yeah, quantum is so weird, and...
Yeah, but it's strangely charming.
Nice.
It's strangely charming when you think about all the up downs.
I swear to God, I'm going to finish that drink, because this was a fabulous, fabulous drink.
I actually put drink on there, so...
All right,
let's talk about quantum. In the Hangover.
It's like a quantum baby.
Okay.
All right. So, thanks for joining us. And whoever joined us, thanks for joining us. Come back and see us again in 2 weeks, and where we will, what month are we in now?
Oh, April. God, what are we? Yeah.
Where we're going to talk about what's happening in May.
I saw the 4 on my computer. I did January, February, March, April.
That's what I usually do. Yeah. Yeah. May high in the sky.
May high in the sky.
It will be our next episode. Yes.
Yeah. So
we may have some scheduled changes coming up just because we're going to have some visitors in town that we may then have to adjust the schedule in May.
Hold on, let's just see if it happens. So.
We'll talk about it. We'll
I'll do the episode myself. Don't worry.
There we go. Yeah, it'll just be Brandon time.
That'd be great.
Yeah. I'll send him the OBS profile.
How deep down the rabbit hole will I go?
Anyway, thanks for joining us. We'll see everybody in 2 weeks. Cheers, everybody.